It is Saturday, April 21st, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. If you'd like to ask us questions and comments about technology or comment about technology, you can do so by calling us in the second half of the show. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in half an hour. If you'd like to get your thoughts in the queue right away, you can sit on hold for half an hour, or you can email us, and we'll get to that as well. But we love to hear your voice. So again, think of what you might want to ask us. Talk about the news, the tech of the week, something you don't understand, something you do understand and want to comment on, or just ask us about problems with your computer. We're here to help. The phone number I will give out again in about 24 minutes when I invite your participation. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Miles, we'll jump on through to your news. Please go for it.
I'm going to start off with, well, since we're coming off of Dr. Don's show, I'm going to do something semi-medical, although hackneyed and ad hoc from the geek point of view. Computer games. Some people love them, some people hate them, some people think that they're a complete waste of a person's life, and other people consider them to be a great enjoyment in addition to their life. Well, in this case, a computer game has been created that helps kids with depression.
Go on.
Researchers or doctors in New Zealand have reported in the British Medical Journal that their fantasy game called Sparks, a 3D game, they performed a test on 94 individuals about the age of 15 when depression is and what this game does is you have an avatar that has to learn to deal with anger, hurt feelings, how to deal with negative emotions and use them in the positive ways, and it gives them a series of 7 challenges over the course of 4 to 7 weeks. What they found was that after 3 months, this game was at least as effective as face-to-face talk therapy, conventional counseling, according to several depression rating scales.
Okay, so we won't get into the details of how you actually rate depression,
sure, but it's pretty not qualified.
No, not at all. But the idea being that if you do, you have a metric to some degree, a psychological metric to find out how well you're coping with depression, how depression's mm-hmm. going for him, for a person, and you can definitely see depression decrease as you get talk therapy. And when playing this game, you see the same type of decreasing. In fact, it's more functional or about the same.
Well, along the different metrics show different results.
Okay.
But they found that it's at least as effective.
So what's this game about? I mean, it's challenges, but what kind of challenges? Like challenges in your life or only challenges in the game? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
it's challenges in the game.
It's for your the avatar you're playing,
yeah.
The character you're playing. It has challenges that are long-reaching.
Yes.
Is this game like a multi-user game?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. I believe it's just a single-person 3D fantasy game.
I was trying to find it. It's called Spark.
Sparks. S-P-A-R-X.
Thank you. I'm sure that will be an easier Google search.
In addition, 44% of the kids who were playing Sparks, mm-hmm. Who carried out at least 4 of the 7 missions, in other words, kept with it, recovered completely. This is in contrast to, because a certain amount of people who are diagnosed with depression in their teenage years will recover mm-hmm. if given treatment. But with conventional treatment, 26% recovered fully.
Interesting. And this is everybody recovers fully that plays the game?
No, this is 44%.
Gotcha.
Of the ones who play the game and actually stick with it, at least
then recover fully. And traditional talk therapy is 23%.
26%.
I would say that's a high change. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it's also something that adolescents can use at their own pace, however much they want to do. And if you find someone who likes playing games,
this is the one.
Like,
okay,
adolescents.
I can't find this URL, and I wanted to know. Like, do you know what the game looks like? Is it a first-person shooter? Is it a top-down view? I need to know this because of my own desire for knowledge.
I'll
Sparks,
see what I can find.
Sparx.
Yes.
I don't know. The first thing I hit is Sparks.
That assumes that it's. I don't believe that it actually
porn,
is
course,
open
so.
for use. I mean,
oh,
this is
okay, okay.
A
so
private
this might
study.
Be
I'm
private.
Sure they're tweaking with it.
Gotcha, gotcha, gotcha. Okay, so development stages. Interesting though. I find that there's a lot of misconceptions about games, and gamers, and it's surprising how many people actually are gamers. You know, if you play more than a couple hours a week, some kind of computer game, that means like. Angry Birds, whatever, you're a gamer. If you play more than 6 hours a week, you're a hardcore gamer, and you'd be surprised how much people are playing these online games.
And playing really bad games.
Yeah. There are some amazing games out there.
Yes. And so, like, to play Farmville is just...
Don't play Farmville. A horrible game. Of course, I've never played it. But, you know, there...
I know someone who is a farmer, who lives on a farm, who plays Farmville.
Don't...
It's like...
That's awesome. Don't you find it the corollary pretty direct, though? Most people see the major motion picture films that are targeted at a large audience, have a predictable plot, and aren't that artistically interesting, in my own opinion. And the games are the same way, right? You find the smaller, more interesting games that are really quite amazing, just like you find the smaller and more interesting films that are quite amazing. And there's a whole industry behind unique and interesting games as well.
I don't know, man. I really liked Avatar.
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, you nerd. You also like Quake.
I mean, it was...
And Quake's
it
one
was
of the bigger games.
Fern Gully with aliens. But at the same time, it was a predictable model. You kind of knew where things were going.
Absolutely.
At the same time, like, it was artistically very beautiful.
Hey, so a while ago we mentioned... We had a whole episode where we tried not to talk about the name of the company because the name of the company actually endorses their business. But it's not Stop Mommy. Okay, it's another one that does DNS. and the reason why it kind of hit our ears is that they were supporting the PIPA and SOPA bills that were going to allow the government to shut down DNS service and other websites.
Yeah, in fact, co-authored
it. And so that company, which we won't mention, did that. They also did some bad things for the employees. It's just not a very good business, but it was the biggest domain name seller.
Sexist ads during the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Pretty sexist ads, exactly. So this company was the top Google hit for domain name searches. Like, you want to get a domain name, they're the top hit. Not just the advertising top hit, but the actual Google search top hit. And recently that was beat by Namecheap, which I'm assuming has a better use policy, though I haven't read it, so I'll mention their name. Namecheap overtakes GoDaddy is basically the story. And it looks like they're about to hit their 3 millionth domain name registration, the company, which is much smaller than Stop Mommy, the inverse of Stop Mommy, that business, which...
Do you know anything about this up-and-comer?
I unfortunately don't, except that they're very successful. Do you know much about it?
Well, that's like saying, yeah, Stop Mommy is very successful. It's all,
I know,
all people
I know.
Know
I'm not
about
saying,
it.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm saying it's a good thing that Stop Daddy's isn't, oops, I said it wrong, Stop Mommy, that company is doing poorer because I think that they should be affected by their bad policies. But anyway.
Assuming that the other one doesn't have bad policies, you don't know.
Valid. All right.
Well, at the same time, we know that Stop Mommy has bad policies.
Exactly. We
Whereas
don't
the
know.
The other one
cheap,
we don't know.
Name
so.
Cheap does, yeah. Of course, we suggest a few different domain names. We've been using for a long time. I really like GKG and Domain Discover. Both of them, GKG.net and DomainDiscover.com. And you like Joker.
Joker.com,
which is a France company.
Swiss, I believe.
Swiss. A European domain name server, I think, is probably a better idea anyway, though, because they do have better privacy policies in Europe than in the Americas. The EU does, at least. So anyways, if you do a Google, you know, people should know that you can do Google searches on site specifics, Google searches. So if you go to Google and you type the word site with a colon and then the domain name that you want to search, like geekspeak.org, and then you do the normal search after that, which would be something like domain name servers, you'd get the pages on our site that talk about domain name servers and what we suggest. So
it would be like one hit.
probably, well, I guess it's six times we talked about
it. Over the course of what is it, 12 years now?
12 years, yeah.
DARPA has an experimental hypersonic technology vehicle.
Oh, I love hypersonic.
Yeah, hypersonic is defined as anything at or above Mach 5.
Oh, okay.
Five times the speed of sound. This one, however, was doing a sustained Mach 20.
I'm assuming no one was in the vehicle.
No, no one was in the vehicle. And it panels peeled apart after 3 minutes of flight.
It was an atmospheric. It was an atmospheric Mach, because that's one of the things about Mach is that Mach changes
on your
based on air pressure. So they do count for that, I'm assuming.
But altitude adjusted, it was Mach 20.
Interesting. That's fast.
Yes, very fast. To give an aspect of this, it went about 750 miles in 3 minutes.
And to be clear, the company that did this was?
No, it's DARPA. So it's a government organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The same folks that the internet came out of. The same folks that have a huge amount of money and people go, what are you doing? Never mind. Here's the internet. Now go leave us alone.
We're making fast things. Burn up. I'm assuming this was self-propelled rather than a projectile.
Yes, this is self-propelled.
Wow. It
had some atmospheric problems where it was the skin was kind of peeling off, and so it was causing it to go into rolls, and it actually recovered quite a few times. But then too much of the skin peeled off, and it couldn't recover anymore, and then it just kind of stopped flying. But that's okay, because that wasn't the point. It wasn't the point to find this production-level vehicle. It was get an experiment that lasts a certain period of time. 3 minutes is actually a very good stretch of time for something going this fast. You have a lot of data that you can pull from. And going 13,000 miles per hour, you know, it's a very interesting thing. Like, can you imagine going from LA to New York in, I don't know, what is that?
Moments?
12 minutes.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But again, no human being was in this vehicle.
Well, currently, yeah.
All right. I don't know how much we've covered this story, but I've been following it. It's pretty interesting. In November, the FBI was going to take down a large hacker ring that was running an ad scam. So an ad scam, basically, you put up a whole bunch of advertising on pages. You kind of direct people to those pages. If they click on those ads, you make money. There's a lot of companies out there that provide that ad service, so it's relatively easy to do that almost anonymously. So the other thing you can do, of course, is what hackers do is they'll take exploits on machines. In this case, it was a Windows exploit. Take over the machine, make some modifications to the machine, and now every time you access the internet, you're actually going through their servers and they add their advertising to the pages you're viewing. So in a world where you were not using a secure connection, you could do a Google search, get a hell of a bunch of ads. All the ads on that page kind of worked, but they are actually going through the hacker that actually had an ownership of your computer. This is a traditional kind of make money off of people. It looks like the group that did this made about $14 million. Now, in November, the FBI was going to take it down. But the thing is, the way the hackers modified the computers is they made it completely transparent to the user that it was going on. So the user didn't have a problem, right, from their perspective.
Right.
And
yeah, that's the common thing we hear from people calling in. I don't have anything on my computer that's all that important, or anyone gets on my hard drive, what are they going to find? They're going to find a computer that they can use to do bad things.
They will take, your computer is a resource, and you are a resource as you browse the internet, in this case, for example. So what the FBI decided to do is, if they were to just kill the servers that were being hosted by this hacker group, the scam group, let's call it a scam group because hacker is not necessarily a bad thing. So the scam group, they took down the servers. All of a sudden, all the people that were infected with this thing wouldn't have DNS anymore, domain name service, which is actually how you use the internet. So nothing would work anymore for them, and their machine would be broken. So the FBI did this thing of like, well, and we're talking about like 600,000 people across the planet.
I mean, it would be an effective way to find out who has this problem. However, it's also interfering with someone's computer without their consent, and therefore a tort.
And the thing is that's tricky about it is, if you do take down the internet for 570,000 people or more, what effect happens to them, right? All those people aren't buying things anymore. So from the government, from a economy perspective, it's not very good. They don't have good access to their information.
Or they could be
their
businesses.
Emails, could be businesses. Most of this was small companies that don't have IT staff.
Right.
But yes,
which
small
is
businesses.
A lot of businesses.
And you know, when we talk about home computers, a lot of home computers are the person's business computer as well. Okay, so it wasn't a good idea to just kill the service and take down all these machines without solving the problem. So the FBI asked a judge to put up a copy system that wouldn't do the bad things but would still provide the DNS service to all these people. And so they got together and hosted a very large network that's still running. Now, it was supposed to end in March, and they got an extension of it because it looks like still 270,000 people or 300,000 people, something like that, are still using this infected system. They haven't been cleaned. And the FBI has been having a lot of trouble getting people to update. Now, it's less than 100,000 in the U.S. It's all across the world. There's like 10 different countries that have over 10,000 people in it.
It's not just us.
It's everybody. So, and the federal government's spending like $87,000 or so to keep the servers online to provide service to infected machines, right? It's a bad scenario. And it looks like in July, they're just shutting it down. So in July, if you lose network, yeah, your machine was infected. It's a very easy thing to find out if your machine is infected. You can actually discover this relatively easy by going to dcwg.org. This is only Windows machines, or at least this exploit is only Windows machines. Again, go to dcwg.org. And if you can't remember that in a little bit, don't forget geekspeak.org. We'll have it linked on the show page.
Right, and before you feel really smug about the fact that you have a Mac and not a Windows machine, this exploit only affected Windows machines. Macs have had a hard couple of weeks.
That's right. Now, we've been saying for years that if there was an exploit on a Mac, we'd mention it on air, and then you'd be worrying about it. And I didn't mention it last week. Man. Yes, your Macintosh, if you haven't updated in a while, is vulnerable to being taken over and pwned by somebody else.
Right. It is a Trojan, not a virus.
That's right. You kind of have to be active in your process with it.
Right.
And actually, we've mentioned about other Trojans as well. There was a torrent collection or a pirated collection of Adobe software that had a Trojan inside it. So if you were pirating, so when people say, I think a while ago at least, people said, I'm a Mac, I think I might be infected. I said, well, do you pirate software? And if you pirated Adobe software, then yeah, you might have an infected machine because that's the only case I've heard of. But now this is much, it's smarter in the way it does it. It prompts you and you have to put in your password and then it owns your machine.
Although I do believe it can come through from the Java plugin.
Yeah, the interesting exploit. It's true. Yeah. The interesting thing is the first case of this Trojan, this version of this Trojan, it had to prompt the user. And then as I guess it got better footing, the developers, the hackers,
they found an exploit in the plugin.
They
yeah.
basically took advantage of a Java plugin. Yeah, and so now this idea is update. You really do need to update. I think Apple's released a Java update. A real simple thing to do. I know you're going to hate this, Miles. You can go into your browser and turn off Java.
I'm perfectly okay with that.
Yeah,
It doesn't affect 99.999% of people because they don't use Java. There's certain apps that you can install through Java, but they aren't that popular.
And if they are useful, you're going to see a warning that says it's disabled. Do you want to enable it? You just enable it.
Right.
So update from Apple, and you can go ahead and disable Java. And if there's an exploit in the future in Java, at least you'll be aware that you're turning it on. I really thought you'd be more offended by that.
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, it's like I said, most people don't ever use it. All it is the annoying orange pop-up that comes up in the bottom right-hand corner on your Windows box. And Java, I personally don't use. Well, I guess I do use one app client-side, but I wrote that, so that's a whole other thing.
What's the client-side you use? What app do you
write? It's an equivalent of caffeine or coffee, which you have.
CoffeeScript?
Yeah. No, the equivalent of...
Oh, caffeine. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a little
preventing
tiny menu item
from coming up.
And, yeah. Is it working Windows as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so Miles has this little app that allows you to run... You run this little application, and when the application's running, the machine will not shut down, and the screen will not go to sleep, which is a very useful thing for art installation, which I'm doing a lot of lately.
Yeah, and the reason I bought it was... Or the reason I wrote it was because I had a Windows box at work, and I have a Mac at home, and I have now a Linux box that I'm using on the show right now. And
have you released this product?
No.
Come on!
Not very good.
Give, give, give. Mine. Whose turn is it? I think it's your turn.
Well, I just brought us into the Apple bug.
Oh, that's right.
So.
Yeah. Any more updates on that? Or are we good? Okay, let me mention this then.
Well, there's still something like a 500,000 people out there that still have that are affected as Mac users.
Yeah. So and there's so much coverage.
It's a large number.
All you need to know is that if you have got a Mac, you need to start updating and you need to start paying attention to that because there are problems on the Macintosh environment. Trojans out there.
Yeah, so. And you can disable Java, and in addition to that, if you get an update from Apple, it will remove any existing infection.
Go do an update from Apple now if you got a Mac. In fact, there's no reason not to do that all the time. You really should be doing that. Okay. If it's a really large update, you can move your machine. And also, Apple allows you to download those updates. And you can download it to friends and move it over on a USB stick. But please, you know who you are.
The little box comes up and saying, do you want to update your computer? You have to restart your computer when the update's done. And you go, oh, not right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Time to say we're talking to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Hardest working man on the internet passes 1 million wiki edits. Not bad, huh? So Wikipedia, of course, everybody knows
is hardest working, really?
Well, I wouldn't say he's the hardest working, but he did edit a million edits.
But you did say he was the hardest working.
Well, I'm saying that because, oh my gosh, that's more than I've done in the last year. But of course, this has been going on.
Yeah, you're a slacker.
Ouch. Justin Anthony Knapp, it doesn't matter what his username is. He has been working on Wikipedia, and he has over 1 million edits to books and news and quotes, and I mean basically all over Wikipedia. He's one of those people that spends a lot of time, and his quote of course is it's amazing, something effective. Oh, being suddenly and involuntarily unemployed will do that to you. He's basically been very effective,
but now, keeping busy.
And I gotta say that editing Wikipedia entries for correctness or for changes, whatever, anybody can do at least one page. Absolutely, right? It's no problem. You can definitely go to geekspeak.org and say it's an awesome show. That won't work, though, because people will remove that comment because it's not factual, right? Is that one of the... But the point is that everybody's little tiny knowledge adds together to a really amazing knowledge base, and that's what Wikipedia is. And yes, it can run amok. You know, there can be elephants. Entries can be modified by Colbert listeners. But in general, it's a relatively good way to collect world knowledge. And I have to say that I think...
For science and mathematics, Wikipedia is actually better than every other encyclopedia source that I've seen. The politics and social theory, those are a lot more contentious and have some more issues.
But I want to just put it out there again that instead of, you know, sitting and watching TV and consuming media and doing a lot of experiencing the world passively, people like Justin are spending time adding to the world's knowledge and cleaning things up and making things better, even in a small way.
And helping college students fake their papers at,
so
you know, at record levels.
Absolutely.
So next story. Now for something completely different. IBM. Big Blue. They have a project called Battery 500. What is Battery 500?
What is Battery 500?
The Battery 500 project is a project started by IBM in 2009 to make a battery capable of moving a car 500 miles.
Not an AA battery.
Right. Now, right now, we have cars out, electric cars out there, and the commercial, the ones that are general consumer, you're getting about 75 to 100 miles, give or take. And if you have enough money for a Tesla, you know, the luxury model, then you can go about 200 or more, depending upon the model. But it's still something that if you want to go on a road trip, you don't want to take your electric car.
Right.
Not unless you have regular family to stop and hang out with and plug your car in overnight, you know, that type of thing. 500 miles, however, is at that range where you're competing with gasoline.
Right.
So what they're coming up with so far, they haven't made it yet, they're still working, is a lithium air battery as opposed to a lithium ion battery. Lithium ion batteries, like many other batteries, are sealed.
Mm-hmm.
So the cathode and the anode are completely sealed from the outside world, you know, and unless they stop being, in which case you have all the battery acid, a little corrosion coming up off the terminals. or off the lid.
Unless, of course, it gets submerged in water and in case it explodes. But that's not how they work now. Lithium's not very stable. Go on.
Right. You may experience some turbulence and then explode. So anyone who gets that reference, yeah, geek points. The battery reacts with oxygen. And it reacts with the lithium to create a lithium peroxide and electrical energy as a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
When you recharge the battery, it releases the oxygen, makes that lithium peroxide solution go back to an elemental lithium.
Wow. So that's cool.
And that's what they're calling an air breathing better. You actually have air going in and out as part of the process.
What's the benefit of this? Is it better? Is it a more electrically engaged reaction, or is it just a lot lighter?
The energy density ends up being on looking to be about 15 times greater than lithium ion. So you're ending up with something that would,
yeah,
a battery that would be 10 times smaller, 10 times lighter, or one tenth the space.
Sure.
And yet the same charge as existing full size lithium ion batteries.
So if you did have a pack in your car that filled your trunk, whatever, like a Prius right now, you'd actually get the 500 miles potentially.
Right. Or if you have a Nissan Leaf right now, you would get 1,000 miles.
Right, right. Now, I got to say that the one thing that I'm excited about that is kind of a universal amongst tech geek people is really good battery technology. When we get really good battery technology, we will take a giant step forward in everything we do.
Right. And if you want a number,
yeah,
the max energy density of lithium ion batteries, about 12 kilowatt hours per kilogram. Just to give a reference point.
That is
point,
a good number.
This is comparable, like approaching gasoline.
Yeah. I've got a geek bit. Do you have a geek bit, Miles?
I'm speaking
with Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. Answering the phone is Rick Philman. 1-800-655-5877. What is it?
My geek bit is that while we are computer geeks, there are many other types of geeks. And there is one geek that is more biology and medical related. Mm-hmm. Who would be my partner, Becca, who has a birthday today. And I would like to wish her a very happy birthday.
Woohoo! Happy birthday, Becca! All right. Awesome. My little geek bit is a great video from, I think it's fun, it's a, I don't know, 10-minute video, maybe 7-minute video or whatever, with three different people talking about copyright. You've got an executive, a lawyer, and an owner of Cheeseburger. You know Cheeseburger, the website that does lolcats and things of that nature? I didn't even know it was like a place, but sure. And it's about, it's Reason TV has it. It's about 7 minutes long. I'll have it up on geekspeak.org. And it's a fun little back and forth, clearly slanted towards Reason. And that copyright's messed up. And I wanted to actually kind of use this to initiate our post-break discussion about copyright. So Miles,
after I finish off the battery one.
Yeah. Oh, you still have more battery one?
Well, a little bit.
All right. What is the rest of your story about batteries?
People talk about, well, then I have this battery and I have to charge it up every 500 miles. I need to have some place where I can charge it up. Although every 500 miles ends up being a lot simpler than every 100 miles or 150. One possibility that has come up is the fact that you don't manufacture your own gasoline. You don't have the gasoline pumped to your house and then bring your car back to your house and then fill it up from
right,
there.
Right.
You do have stations that have the gasoline and you just
have
a
tank. Yeah, but it takes 4 minutes to fill your gas tank.
Right. But what if you didn't own your battery?
Ah.
What if you just depleted the battery, you take the battery out, and they put a new one in, and then you drive away?
A lot like a propane tank for a barbecue at home,
mm-hmm,
where you have to take it to
or
the place.
Or a
of course
lot
it's
like
portable.
Filling your tank
yeah.
of gasoline.
It's just that you change hardware, not just the energy. Yeah, cool.
Sure.
All right, so that's the solution to the problem of how do you go 4,000 miles.
Yeah. If electric car makers can make a standardized size and connector for it.
That's a very big if.
Yeah, well.
Okay, real quick. Copyright. I want to say something because I've been thinking about this and I don't mention enough on GeekSpeak. I don't think the current federal government's copyright rules are correct. I think they're messed up and they're misaligned. What's your feeling? Of course, the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP.
I think the copyright is too long. I think that if someone can be born after Mickey Mouse was created and live a whole full life and then die without Mickey Mouse falling into the public domain, being able to use it at will as part of your culture means that culture gets owned indefinitely.
I think what happens with the problem with having so much copyright is that the discussion is talking about, it goes into the space of this idea of theft, which we get in this little crumbling. It's not really theft because the other person doesn't lose it, but just, you know, being supporting the artist, that's always a good stumbling block. But the point is that every time you get to a point where you kind of have a problem, like how do you support the artists? How do you make sure that people that are creating content keep creating content? How do you make sure that they make a living? All of those things. How do you make sure people don't steal stuff? That is not the end point of the conversation. That's an interesting idea, but that should be a fundamental part of this conversation. The thing you should start with is, how do we have a society in which creative people are encouraged to be creative? And in our society where we're financially motivated, then we should have some contingent to structure that a person that's creative gets money for what they do.
Well, let's,
and if we start there and stop with the whole argument of where we are right now with the MPAA and all that, we get to a much more reasonable place where almost everyone can agree that we do want to support creative people's endeavors. We want them to be successful. We want them to keep on making creative. If we start there and then look at law that can help make that happen, that is a very much better discussion than trying to make sure that Disney stays in business. Like, I don't care about that. I care about my cultural experience. I care about being a human being.
Well, the goal of copyright was to encourage people to create new items. Yeah. And in the last 50 or so years, 40 years, Congress has retroactively extended the length of copyright.
Which is in
which is
reverse to making endorsing for creative
work. How can you incentivize something that's already been created? I do have to wonder, though, I'm just wondering out loud, if copyright were 27 years long, like it was with the first copyright laws of the U.S.
First one was 14, but go on.
No, patents was 14.
Oh.
Copyright was 27. Country was first formed, it was different.
But right,
the
right,
first but actual law that was made after that was 27, I believe. Ask your musician friends, if we were to make copyright 27 years long instead of
indefinite, 100 years.
Essentially indefinite, would they stop making music?
Right.
Would that disincentivize them? Do they think that they would be affected very adversely? Affected adversely and monetarily.
And here's the thing that you have to really understand about the creative process. Creative processes do not emerge out of nothing. They emerge from a person or a group of people based on their cultural experience, partially. And if they are not allowed to use their cultural experience in the ways that allows them to be creative in their way, you're restricting their creative process. You're not encouraging it at all. So, for example, what would happen right now if Mickey Mouse was completely available and people could make their own stories and ideas out of Mickey Mouse? Now, Mickey would change. Culturally, it would change, right? It would become something completely different that we're not aware of. But it would allow people to be creative in a way that we haven't seen before.
Or it would diversify.
And who knows what would happen? Something very amazing might actually happen. Mickey's a great example of ridiculousness because, of course, the first... Well, we won't go more into that.
Yeah, the copyright extension was basically because of Mickey Mouse, so that's why we always bring it up.
Yeah. Anyway, if you want to learn more about that in kind of a fun, short way, my geek bit for today is all about that little quick video. Okay, so let's talk about games that change behavior with Eric from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Howdy. I like that little story, but it sort of brings back the old argument that games that show bad behavior can actually... cause those kinds of behaviors too, and I was just wondering what you thought about.
Yeah,
you know, there's two sides to that sword.
Right. When we're talking positively about games, that Miles and I will do, of course, even though we don't play much games now because we're parents. But when we talk about that, we have this kind of leaning side to say, "Yeah, games are cool, isn't it? Cool, the story's nice because it talks about how games can help people." And then, of course, if you start talking about the modifications of behavior from games, that argument of, well, if people are playing violent games that kill people, of course they're going to be more violent, which is not something that you see in test results. But what did I think about that? I didn't think about that aspect.
You do among young people who have a predilection towards violence already or antisocial behavior. So if they are playing violent games, that can exacerbate it. But then again, this game that's modeled against depression... if you have someone who's well adjusted, chances are they're not going to become happier because of this game. They're going to remain well adjusted.
Yeah. I think that just because there is this perceived corollary in your thought, and I agree that there's a little connection there that, you know, we argue against the idea that games really modify people's behavior when we don't like the idea that they modify it into a socially bad way, but we love the idea when it modifies a person in a good way. You have to also think that it's a depression and acting out against people are very different things. You know, when you're talking about a well-adjusted social experience, having a conversation with a person, having tea with a person, or chasing them in a sports game are completely different things and are going to produce different results in the people. And both of them can have beneficial and bad things. But because they're very different experiences, we can't necessarily say one occurs and one doesn't.
Yeah. That said, I will say that if you're spending 12 hours a day playing a game by yourself, it's probably not going to be healthy, no matter how.
Like, it's hard to say what's healthy, though. I mean,
social interaction? I would call that healthy.
Part of it is it's clear that the cues in a Grand Theft Auto are very different than the real world, whereas the cues intended, I'm sure, in this thing for suppression are much closer to what people would see in the real world. So therefore, they should be closer.
That's a very interesting point, and yet the fact that you brought up Grand Theft Auto is something I wanted to talk about, which was that at least the most recent one, Grand Theft Auto 4, I think it was.
Yeah.
The issue I have with violence in video games is violence without consequence, without any context. And that's the case with when I watch movies as well. If you have something that's just some big, steroid guy with a big gun killing everyone in their path, and that's supposed to be glorified. That I have a problem with, but something where you're seeing the horrors of war, it's very violent, and you see this knowledge of, like, this is not something to be glorified. This is not something
I watched Babel recently, by the way, speaking of unromanticized violence.
And so with Grand Theft Auto 4, even though it gets very maligned, Grand Theft Auto 4 was a character. I highly encourage some people to check it out if you haven't, not just go from the news reports. The character at the end, if you finish the game and the character ends up being this kingpin.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, you kind of feel sorry for the character. You don't feel like, oh my god, this is a great person. It's
interesting.
In some ways,
okay,
like watching Scarface, you don't empathize with the character saying, yeah, I want to be that Al Pacino.
You say, I definitely don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, that was a bad sequence.
Well, I think Eric's point, though, is that if a game that you argue lots of times that game's not going to produce violence because, of course, it's so ridiculous that you kind of know it's a game. But in a situation where you're actually reproducing a social structure in a game that helps people with their depression, maybe that's going to be much closer to reality and therefore a more effective process on modifying someone's experience or modifying the personality, which, of course, is the goal of that game is to modify their personality, right? It's to get them out of depression. But the thing is, I don't know if that's necessarily true, Eric. We don't know a lot about the game. But, of course, it might not be true. It might be true that just an experience of, doing tic-tac-toe, really difficult at the beginning, and then it gets easier and easier for you to do it as you get better. That's all it is, right? It might just be a game that allows you to get better at something and rewards you with praise.
Or it teaches problem solving. And if you have better problem solving skills, then you're able to deal
right.
and cope
so
with situations that you haven't come across
before. It might not be a society emulation system. It might be a thing that helps boost your confidence. Does that make sense, Eric?
But if you think of it and think of it like as just training assistance where, there's some subliminal stimulus that you match to a behavior, and that's part of, I imagine, what's in there. I tend to think more like science fiction movies where I can start saying, well, hey, maybe Facebook puts a couple of interesting things, or not Facebook, but Farmville or whatever, that all of a sudden there's an interesting social behavior that we could start generating that may or may not be wanted.
Absolutely.
That's a judgment call, but I think all those things are possible.
I think that's definitely possible, and I think that game theory is a lot about getting people engaged and interested in what they're doing. That's like that's the goal, right? Is to get them.
That's what psychology is about.
Yeah,
that's what marketing is about.
Yeah, and you see this taking place that it's revolutionizing marketing. This idea of giving badges to people for success in different things, like sharing your farm crops with people. This idea that the game aesthetic can invade your life. And there's a really wonderful TED Talk I can't reference perfectly right now about this idea of a future society that's based completely on game mechanics that makes you a better person. You exercise more, your medical insurance goes down because they keep track of that information. And as you exercise more, you get more points, and therefore your medical insurance go down. And eventually you get a free ice cream because you've done so well at your exercising process. And this is like completely managed in a society way. That's an interesting idea. And I think we are in that space. We're not doing it with plan, though. We're doing it kind of randomly. Right. Eric, thanks for the call. We're going to keep going on the show.
And as a side note, with regard to marketing, and the notion of subliminal messages, I don't know if subliminal is the right word. It's more just like affecting how people perceive.
Right.
Or, I mean, taking advantage of the way people perceive. And if you want to have a good way of combating that, or to see behind the veil, to see what how someone is trying to manipulate you, it's a very telling thing that many marketing books or textbooks or just marketing materials in general, when they talk about how do you market more effectively, that those tips are almost always an exact copy of what you would find in a book on formal logic under logical fallacies.
Yeah, it's true.
They're one for one. Like the argument by ad populum. In other words, because it's popular, everyone's supposed to do that. Except in marketing, they call that the bandwagon.
Right.
And it's very effective because there are logical fallacies that are popular because we, you know, buy into them.
Martin from Virginia, in Vienna, actually, Virginia. Martin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, actually, it's Mark.
Oh, well, hi, Mark.
Hi.
Did I get the city right or the state?
Yeah, Vienna, right. Virginia.
Right. Hi, Mark. You know, I love this. We use a Google Doc to communicate with Rick in the other room. And as you said, actually, it's Mark. He's correcting, and I can see his cursor flying across my screen, changing it to be Mark. And he says he's sorry, but I am as well. Hi, Mark. What's up?
Hi. I got a question which just came up when I was speaking to a friend, and it stumped me, and I was thinking I would give it a try on you. But this individual, he happened to be dealing with Craigslist, but there, you know, there are a lot of websites out there with mail to links on them.
Yes.
And when you click on the mail to, what it likes to do is bring up your email client and, you know, generate a window to compose a message and fill in the address.
Yeah, and sometimes you can actually fill in more than just the address with that mail to link. You can do a subject line.
Okay. But the issue my friend is having is he doesn't use a mail client.
He uses a web browser?
Yeah, he uses a web browser. Is there any way,
yes,
with any common, you know, good browser, to configure the browser to say, you know,
open your mail client? Yeah, absolutely. There's plugins for browsers of Firefox, Chrome, and Opera that does this for multiple types of systems.
Unfortunately, Safari does as well.
Okay.
They're usually site specific, so you'd need one specific tool for
Google Mail,
for Gmail versus Yahoo Mail versus those.
Absolutely. If he goes to the mail settings of his website, he should be able to find a tool like that. Unless it's a small mom and pop shop that doesn't have this, and then in which case, I don't know how to do it.
Although it seems to me there's also a way to do it in a browser. I can't remember off the top
there's
of my head,
a way to do it generically, too.
Where you're able to tell a browser, if you have this protocol in front, like Mail 2, to prefix it with this URL, which you can pass it to a webmail client
and
have it work.
Yeah, this is a plug-in thing, definitely. It's not that hard to set up.
Okay, so I need to look in plugins.
Yeah, you need to look in plugin extensions. Find out what browser he uses, and if he's using Internet Explorer, switch away from that. Probably use Chrome.
No. We got him off of IE long.
Good. And then also, depending on the mail.
You are a good friend.
Depending on the mail service. The thing is, you know, Yahoo and Gmail are going to have tools that do exactly this. They'll probably be a little more bloaty than they need to be, but they'll work.
Yeah.
Smaller shops, you can talk to them directly if you know you're dealing with a smaller mail service provider, like a local ISP, and talk to them about it. And they'll probably try to help you with that, because using a web interface is always a nice way to interact with mail. Thank you so much, Mark. For the call.
Thank you.
Mark from Vienna, Virginia. We also have, we have more people, so we'll just keep going, I think. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam, and we have Rick answering phones in the other room. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Local to home, Scotts Valley. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling because I find missing information on security topics. The first one is security against the operating system and programs you use leaving tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is security against external infection or use of your computer when you are connected to the Internet. I think it's scandalous that Microsoft doesn't have an operating system that just by its own nature protects us against
attack from outside. Keep in mind that it's a very complicated process, and Microsoft has one of the best antiviruses packages out there. So you can pay them extra money and they'll protect
and
the
actually
machine.
The operating system has, if you're serving XP, yeah, you're going to have a problem. The security model for Vista and for Windows 7
much
is
better.
Vastly improved.
But let's talk about real quick, you mentioned two things, and actually one is privacy and one is security, and they are different.
Yes.
And in fact, are sometimes inversely different in some attributes. So when you talk about leaving tracks, like your application leaves a track on what you've been doing, that's actually a privacy. If that information is something that you want to keep secret, the act of keeping it secret is security information, right? Like, I mean, you need to have good security to keep that private from somebody. But it's about privacy. So I'm assuming you're talking about web browsers. You can set up any web browser right now to not record track information. You can actually have it set up in a session state that makes sure it doesn't do that. If you're really curious about this, you kind of need to do some reading about it because it's actually quite complicated. One thing to note is that your ISP pretty much knows exactly what you're doing, and you're trusting them, right? They know what domain names you're going to. They know what IP addresses you're going to, and they can inversely find out what domain name you're going to. So there's no way for
Although they cannot find your credit card. Oh, they probably already have your credit card number because you're paying them as an ISP, but they can't tell what transactions
you're
making.
If you want to be extremely private, like no one knows what you're doing, look into a service called Tor, T-O-R. You're doing a search for Tor. You can use that. It's going to be slower, and you're doing kind of a strange technical dance, which is kind of neat. It's socially created. But it does work, and you can be extremely private. In fact, you can use Tor and buy illegal drugs in the U.S. and get them shipped to your home, and the only risk you have is that in the mail process you'll get hit, right? But you can connect up. There's services that do that.
We're going to refrain from talking about illegal activities.
Why? It's just communication, information. There's nothing wrong with that.
So at any rate, another possibility is getting, for example, the Chrome browser and having it set up so that it always starts in private browsing mode.
Yeah, Chrome and Firefox both have a private browsing mode.
Yeah, which means that you're able to do everything that you would normally do, but at the end of it, it gets rid of all your cookies, gets rid of all of your browser history. You start off with a clean slate every time you start up.
I do that whenever I'm searching for something that I find that might be offensive to somebody, especially if you're on somebody else's computer. You always do that because if you go and visit someone else's computer to log in with your Gmail account or something, you don't really want any settings accidentally to be saved, and you also don't want to show up as them. What if they haven't logged out of their Gmail account? So you open a incognito window is one of the terms for it, and all of a sudden now you have a new, clean, fresh slate, and when you close that window, you've left no tracks for them. So it's a polite thing to do.
Yeah,
as well.
The drawback to that is those times when you open up your browser and you go to your webmail and you're automatically logged in, that won't work anymore. You have to remember your username and password and put it in every single time you start your browser.
Thank you, John.
Actually, I'm thinking of something even simpler. I mean, when you delete a file, it isn't erased, and you've left the contents of that file in your computer.
That's right. Yes. So there's a couple things to do.
It's a general problem because every program stores intermediate files.
In fact, that's totally true. If you're really concerned about this, what you want to do is get an encrypted hard drive. It's the only way to deal with this process at a really hardware level. The new iOS devices all have this kind of built-in idea that the file's encrypted.
Windows as well.
So the hard drive itself looks like a completely random set unless you know the encryption key. And the trick with this, the reason why I always avoid doing this is if you do make a mistake and you lose the encryption key, if you have any kind of problems, you just can't recover the data. It's just gone.
Yeah, if you forget your password,
you are not in good shape.
You start over again.
But also, if you have any hard drive problems, you can't scan the hard drive with another tool set and try to get the files back out. That's just not going to work for you. You really are. Well, if it's a hard, unless you know the password on the hardware key. Right. So I mean, what I'm saying is the data is not stored in a way that's actually
accessible. Well, you don't necessarily want a hardware key. You can just do it with like TrueCrypt, which is a completely software solution, and that will work just fine.
No, but I'm talking about if your registry, your partition gets corrupted. You're now dealing with an encrypted drive that has a partition corruption. You can't use the traditional tools to get the data off, recover the data. Anyways, you can't search for the end of JPEG file extension, which I do all the time. But anyway, maybe that's a deeper subject. Clearly Miles knows something I don't know. So John, that's what you need to do, is you need to get a hardware secured hard drive. It's a hardware level.
It's really hardware.
Wonderful.
Level.
Sorry, that's not true. Miles is correct. You can do a software encrypted drive. You have to do it such that
there's a software package called TrueCrypt.
Yes,
it works for Macs, Windows, Linux. It's relatively easy to use.
It's a new you need to do a new install
right.
of your operating system.
You may not have to. I don't know.
I mean, and keeping in mind a hard drive potentially keeps little data, We're running out of time, though.
Sorry about that.
Thank you, John, for the call. It is a frustrating process. Take care. I don't think we got more time. No, I think we're done with the show. If you got left on the line and we didn't get to your call, you are welcome to email us. In fact, we pretty much read every email we get. We don't always answer every email, but we do read every email. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.
So I did want to bring up one last tiny thing, which was with regard to when you delete your files, the files are still there. That is a feature, not a bug. Because if you were to actually go and wipe out the file, like overwrite it seven times with zeros and ones so it was gone, your computer would be about two orders of magnitude slower whenever it accessed the hard drive.
That's right. One of the things that slows a computer down is your hard drive access. The more you do that, the more slow your machine will be.
So it's a trade-off to say, do you want your system to be almost unusably slow, or do you want to have the data still stick around and you just get rid of the reference
file? It's not true with TrueCrypt. It takes a little bit more time, but not really that much. And that's pretty secure.
Well, there the CPU is handling the buffer. The hard drive doesn't really have to work harder.
You've been listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me has been Miles Elam. Miles, thanks for being here this morning.
My pleasure.
I appreciate you listening to GeekSpeak. If you'd like to make comments, please do so. You can go to geekspeak.org to find how to do so. And of course, we'd love rankings and such on iTunes and the like. Talk to you next week.